This is the Breaker.News podcast for March 10th, 2019. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature. The SNC-Lavalin scandal turns 1 month old. And The Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or did the BC Legislative Assembly Management Committee make the right decision to hire Beverly McLaughlin to investigate the suspended clerk and sergeant-at-arms? There could be no more of an eminent jurist than McLaughlin, the former Chief Justice of Canada's highest court. She'll have the power to compel testimony and documents from witnesses. She'll determine whether Clerk Craig James and Sergeant-at-Arms Gary Lenz did enough to be fired. Right now, they are suspended and under RCMP investigation. The only problem is the process is so slow. Her deadline is May the 3rd. The Court of Public Opinion is already on Speaker Darrell Plekis' side, and his two reports did as promised. They sickened and angered British Columbians about waste and corruption at the legislature. The Legislative Assembly Management Committee heard this week that policies are being developed on the purchase of BC beer and wine, employee travel, executive compensation, and other areas that Plekis identified in his reports. Meanwhile, we wait for the NDP government to amend the Freedom of Information Law to add the legislature. MLAs are off until March 25th, so let's hope that's when they begin the long overdue reforms to the province's Freedom of Information Law. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Los Angeles Times, Kevin Baxter reports, U.S. women's soccer players sue for equal treatment just months before World Cup. For the second time in 3 years, the rock stars of United States soccer, members of the world champion women's team, have sued their federation, alleging systemic gender-based discrimination in wages and other terms. Their lawsuit, filed in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles on International Women's Day, comes less than 3 months before the reigning world champions are scheduled to open defense of their title in the Women's World Cup in France. It says that U.S. soccer, quote, utterly failed to promote gender equality, end quote, and that the federation officials have claimed, quote, market realities are such that women do not deserve to be paid equally to the men, end quote. According to the lawsuit, if the men's and women's national teams each played 20 exhibitions in a year, winning all of them, the women would earn a maximum of $99,000, or $49.50 a game, while similar men's players would make $263,330, or $13,166 a game. The men's team also traveled on charter flights 17 times in 2017. The women flew commercial. And from 2014 to 2017, the women played 13 of 62 domestic games on artificial surfaces, which are considered more taxing and dangerous, while the men played 48 of 49 on natural grass when they played in the U.S. In ABC News Australia, gun ownership in New South Wales surges past 1 million mark just in time for state election. Data showing New South Wales has a fast-growing appetite for gun ownership has fueled a battle between the Shooters, Fishers, and Farmers Party and the Greens just a fortnight from the state election. There are now more than 1 million registered guns in New South Wales, and 90,000 have been registered in the past 2 years alone, according to New South Wales Firearms Registry data released under Freedom of Information laws. That means there is now one registered firearm for every 8 New South Wales citizens, according to Gun Control Australia. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden comes to the aid of Portland Trailblazers Ennis Kenter. In a letter to Secretary of State Pompeo, Wyden wrote that Cantor has, quote, eloquently and powerfully exercised his freedom of conscience to criticize Turkey's President Erdogan, quote, and likened Erdogan's tactics to that of Russian President Vladimir Putin. In 2017, Cantor's Turkish passport was revoked and he was detained in a Bucharest airport while traveling in Romania. In January, Turkish prosecutors issued an international warrant for his arrest. Currently, an Interpol red notice has been issued for him. Because of these issues, Cantor did not travel with the Blazers last week for their road game at Toronto. In the Seattle Times, Sarah Jean Green reports, major prostitution bust. Seattle police raid 11 massage parlors, freeing 26 women. Five spa owners or operators were arrested in a synchronized early morning raid late last week, and a few hours later, teams of police officers forced entry into 11 massage parlors, most of them clustered around South Jackson Street in Seattle's Chinatown International District. 26 Chinese women, many of them new arrivals who spoke little or no English, were removed from the parlors, where they lived and worked in squalid, dingy conditions. King County prosecutors have since charged two men and three women with money laundering and 3 to 6 counts each of second-degree promoting prostitution. A fourth woman, believed to have returned to China in 2017, was also charged but remains at large. Two of the suspects posted bail and were required to turn over their passports, according to prosecutors. And in the Times columnist, Louise Dixon reports, $1.1 million stash of cash found in blocks, charges tossed. Alexander Defar Zad was charged with possessing cocaine and possessing MDMA for the purpose of trafficking, possession of GHB, and having $1.14 million in his possession, knowing that all or part of the proceeds had been obtained from the commission of an offense. The proceeds of crime charge was thrown out after a preliminary hearing in 2018. The $1.14 million is now the subject of a forfeiture application by the Crown. This week, Defar Zad pleaded guilty to possession of cocaine for the purpose of trafficking. The count arose out of a second search of Defar Zad's house on August 11, 2016. A date for Defar Zad's sentencing is expected to be set in early April. The 51-year-old is not in custody. He was released on $50,000 bail 2 years ago. And in the Breaker.news this week, we reported Wilkinson's constituency office spending out of whack. BC Liberal leader Andrew Wilkinson has charged taxpayers more than $44,000 for a digital marketing agency called Motion Tide Media of Parksville. In 2017, the Breaker.news exclusively reported that Wilkinson spent almost $59,000 on ads. It was the biggest line item on Wilkinson's $120,000 constituency office cost summary. While Wilkinson was the minister in charge of government advertising and communications, he went on a $30,000 ad buying spree on CKNW and CFMI from the end of December 2016 to the start of February 2017 to promote himself and the BC Liberals. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.news podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau. No! Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau suffered another loss from cabinet last week. Treasury Board President Jean Philpott quit in support of her friend, former Attorney General Jody Wilson-Raybould. Trudeau held a news conference on March 7th, but only dug himself a deeper hole. He refused to apologize, and he revealed that he had no evidence that SNC-Lavalin's 9,000 jobs in Canada were at risk.
Global.
Hi, Amanda Connolly with Global. Prime Minister, thank you for taking our questions today. Just to clarify, are you apologizing for anything today?
I will be making an Inuit apology this afternoon, but in regards to standing up for jobs and defending the integrity of our rule of law, I continue to say that there was no inappropriate pressure. obviously reflecting on lessons learned through this, and I think Canadians expect that of us, that any time we go through periods of internal disagreement and indeed challenges to internal trust as we have, there are things that we have to reflect on and understand and do better next time.
Abigail Beeman taking the follow-up question. Both Mr. Wernick and Mr. Butts testified that they had no direct empirical evidence of this $9,000 potential job loss, that number that kept being floated around. Did you have any evidence of 9,000 jobs potentially being lost?
We had heard representations from various sources, including the company itself, that this was an issue of deep concern to them and that it would potentially have consequences as dire as the company having to leave Canada altogether. And that would be something that obviously would have a severe impact on the thousands of people employed right across the country by this engineering firm. So this was an issue that we understood was serious, but as I said, and as I continue to say, the decision around a DPA is not mine to make.
Trudeau's news conference was the day after his former principal secretary, Gerald Butts, testified to the Justice Committee. Butts turned the tables on Wilson Raybould and denied much of what she said the previous week. Ontario NDP MP Charlie Angus grilled Butts.
Mr. Angus.
It's about her credibility.
It is about what happened.
Okay.
And there are different perspectives on what happened.
I see.
I am not here to call anybody names, and you will not get me to cast aspersions.
I'm not asking you to call someone names. I'm asking whether or not there was interference, because facts, my
no
friend,
is
as
the
you
answer
said,
to that question.
Facts
no.
is are no very is stubborn, because I will ask you then, it's not just her, but Ms. Philpott said, I have lost confidence. I must abide by my ethical and constitutional obligations because of the allegations of interference by your office. There can be a cost to acting on one's principle, but there is a greater cost in abandoning them. So is Ms. Philpott not understanding this either?
I would certainly agree with the last statement that there is a cost to abiding by one's principles, as is there a cost to abandoning them.
Green Party leader Elizabeth May took aim at the high-level lobbying by SNC-Lavalin.
I am surprised that in your evidence you don't make reference to two people that I think played a very big role in this drama, the clerk of the Privy Council and the lawyer for SNC-Lavalin. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask how it is that you don't seem to recognize that the heaviest intimidation of our former Attorney General came from one-on-one meetings with the clerk of Privy Council September 19th, and that with that following phone call December 19th, and I will let you know, I completely believe every word we heard from Jody Wilson-Raybould without a doubt. So how is it that your evidence doesn't make reference to his actions, and did you know that he was going to phone her at home on December 19th and make veiled threats?
No, and I'm aware that the clerk and the deputy minister of justice are appearing later. So I want, I know you'll have an opportunity to speak to them directly, but I will say about the clerk of the Privy Council, whom I've gotten to know fairly well over the past 3.5 years, that I find the accusations leveled against him completely inconsistent with his character. He has made enormous family and personal sacrifices to continue to serve the people of Canada. And I just can't imagine a circumstance where Michael Wernick would do the things he is alleged to have done. I find that even less credible given the fact that I am alleged to have done things I know I didn't do.
Privy Council Clerk Michael Wernick made his second appearance at the committee. He was asked about perceptions of Liberal bias and his communication with SNC-Lavalin, including its chair, former Clerk Kevin Lynch. NDP MP Murray Rankin.
How can we have listened to your testimony last time, and of course if we believe Madam Wilson-Raybould's testimony, do anything but conclude that you have in fact crossed the line into partisan activity?
I can only repeat, I state categorically that I have never given advice or done anything for partisan purposes, which would suggest to advantage one political party versus another in the political arena.
Conservative MP Pierre Poilievre.
You told the Attorney General that there would be a board meeting of SNC-Lavalin within 3 days, and they will be likely be moving to London. Who told you that SNC would likely announce a move of its headquarters to London at its September 20th, 2018 board meeting?
That is not my recollection of what I said.
But once again, my question, very simple. Did you or the Prime Minister ever tell the Attorney General that the headquarters would move if she did not sign a deferred prosecution agreement?
No.
Yes, you did not.
No, I did not.
Conservative MP Lisa Raitt.
And my concern is this. Section 33 of the Conflict of Interest Codes sets out exactly what a previous office holder can and cannot do. And what it says is no former public office holder shall act in such a manner as to take improper advantage of his or her previous public office. Now, you rejected all SNC. You told us with great glee that you walked out of an important dinner that you wanted to go to because you didn't want to be seen with them, and yet you took a call from a former clerk. Do you have concerns that the former clerk breached his duties and obligations to Canada?
No.
You don't think that you took the call from Kevin Lynch because he was the former clerk of the Privy Council?
No.
Why did you take the call from Mr. Lynch?
Mr. Lynch was the chair of the board. I knew this was an active issue in October. I took the meeting with the company. They are not a pariah. It was not improper to have communications with the company. The conversation was a telephone conversation, not a meeting, and it lasted less than 10 minutes. Mr. Lynch, as the chair of the board, expressed his frustration that he did not understand why a DPA was not being considered. And he knew that the board, in its trustee relationships for the shareholders in the company, was going to have to take some tough decisions in October and November. My recollection of the conversation is he asked, isn't there anything that can be done? And I told him in the firmest, curtest possible terms, no, he would have to go through the Attorney General and the DPP through his counsel.
Wow. So not more than 2 weeks ago, when you gave your first testimony about having no contact with SNC, you said nothing about this phone call, and yet today you
have... I was cut off, if you recall, Ms. Raitt. I was proceeding to read the chronology, and I was cut off with it incomplete and undertook to provide the chronology to the committee, which I have done.
Well, thank you for cutting me off, Clerk. But as I was going to say, I think it's incredibly pertinent, and you must have had a knowledge of it because you gave us almost a verbatim right now about what the content of that telephone call is. Can you not see how disturbing this could be for Canadians to see that former clerks who are now chairs of boards of SNC-Lavalin have easy access and immediate access into the central office of this government, into your office, when you turned down everybody else and walked out of a gala because you didn't want to see SNC anymore? Do you not see that as a problem for this country?
No.
Meanwhile, the Federal Court of Canada dismissed SNC-Lavalin's bid to overturn the prosecution service's denial of a plea bargain. It had the effect of validating Wilson-Raybould's decision. The company could still appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada or hope that new Attorney General David Lametti bends to their demands. There is much more to come in this story, and the Breaker.news will bring it to you. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week, we end the Breaker.news podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a deserving person or group of people who made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the Vancouver Police Award of Merit winners, including Randy and Utah Helton, for coming to the aid of a neighbor who had been stabbed by his roommate. For Matthew Carvalho and Jae-Woo Lee, who disarmed a man with a knife at a Starbucks. And Jonas Dow, who tackled a man who stole an elderly man's bag. Citizens helping citizens, a cornerstone of community. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting. Custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. We'll be right back. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for March 10th, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on March 10th in 1959, 60 years ago today, it was the Tibetan Uprising? 300,000 people surrounded the Dalai Lama's palace in Lhasa, fearing the People's Liberation Army would kidnap their spiritual leader. The Dalai Lama fled to exile in India a week later. The army eventually fired on the palace, killing hundreds, if not thousands, of Buddhist monks. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news, and you can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. Be like Vicky Drader, Barbara May, Daniel McElroy, Deborah Jones, Laura Galanders, Mark Speyer, and Monday Redman. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.